Hello and welcome to the Health Report with me, Norman Swan. Today, learning from failure. A courageous researcher talks about why a much-touted trial of personalised cancer treatment failed and what the lessons are if so-called targeted cancer therapy is to come of age. If you or someone you know is contemplating surgery in the near future, stay listening. A fascinating study which zeroes in on getting rid of stuff around the operation that doesn't work and putting you in the best position to get through it well. It includes, interestingly, carb loading and fasting to lower your risk of breast cancer and maybe other forms of cancer too. No, I'm not talking about the 5-2 diet, which everyone seems to be on at the moment. It's about how long you do without food overnight between dinner and breakfast, which arguably is what we evolved to cope with. Catherine Marinac works in the Department of Health Sciences at the University of California, San Diego.
Studies have found that women that work the night shift, which implies nighttime eating, are at a greater risk of breast cancer. And recently there's been some widely publicized work in rodents suggesting fasting schedules that either reduce or eliminate nighttime eating, such as a long nighttime fasting interval, may be effective in improving metabolic factors that we think are related to breast cancer risk. And we wanted to see how this type of fasting schedule could influence some of these metabolic factors in humans.
Now, these metabolic factors relate to your blood sugar and your insulin levels.
Exactly. And we specifically looked at biomarkers of glycemic control.
Glycemic meaning sugar control.
Exactly. In particular, we looked at two, hemoglobin A1C, which is really a biomarker that looks at glucose levels over a number of weeks or months. And we also looked at postprandial glucose, which is an indicator of your glucose clearance after a meal.
And just, again, to explain, anybody who's got type 2 diabetes that's listening to us or type 1 diabetes knows their HbA1c well because their doctor uses it to measure how well their blood sugar is controlled. And postprandial sugar is where you have a meal and 2 hours later you do a blood sugar to see just how efficiently you're getting rid of your blood sugar. And in a sense, the lower the better, and high postprandial blood sugars are not good.
Right.
And then the next stage in that logical thought is that there's some evidence that if your insulin levels are high, it induces growth factors which make your cells grow uncontrollably or potentially.
Yep. So high levels of either insulin or glucose have been thought to fuel tumor growth and progression. And we look in these large-scale public health studies, and there's shows that higher women with higher concentrations of these markers of glucose or insulin levels have higher rates of breast cancer. And that kind of builds upon the evidence that's accumulating that's showing that there's really a close connection between diabetes and cancer. Women with type 2 diabetes have been shown to have about a 20% increased risk of breast cancer and upwards of a 40% increased risk of death from breast cancer. So it's stemming from that evidence showing these effects between insulin and glucose regulation and cancer risk.
So what did you do in this study?
We used data from the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, which is a continuous annual survey that collects information on health and nutrition status of adults in the U.S. And this data set includes data from over 2,000 non-diabetic women. And we used self-reported dietary intake data to get an estimate of variables related to dietary behaviors. So in particular, we looked at things like eating frequency, nighttime fasting duration, evening calorie intake, and total daily calorie intake. And we looked at the associations between these eating behavior variables, such as length of the nighttime fasting interval, and these glucose control parameters.
So again, these women had blood tests done?
Yes.
And presumably you allowed for other things that could have had an impact, how fat they were, how much exercise they got, and all sorts of things like that.
We controlled for things like age and race and body mass index. We controlled for how much they ate, so their total caloric intake. And we also looked at things that might influence the association, like how much they were exercising and how much sleep we got.
Which is interesting because one of the theories behind this is if it's true, this link between glucose and metabolism and nighttime eating, which might not be what we evolved to do, is that we shift our body clocks and therefore our body clocks are out of kilter.
Yep, and that's one of the hypotheses, is that we are programmed to do things at certain times during the day. So we have this master biological clock, which governs many of our metabolic processes, making sure they're performed at optimal times. It's kind of why we feel jet-lagged when we go to a different time zone. So our hypothesis is when we're doing these behaviors like eating out of the natural circadian time, we think that offsets our natural circadian rhythms. And evidence from small-scale clinical studies or rodent models are showing that when our circadian clocks are offset, that can have big implications for our metabolic health or chronic disease risk.
So what did you find?
We found that in general, women that had a longer nighttime fasting duration had better glycemic control. And these effects were independent of participant characteristics such as age and race and BMI, as well as dietary behaviors like how many calories they ate or their eating frequency.
And it was dose related, because one of the things when you look for whether something is an association or a cause and effect is if you do more of it, you get a bigger effect. So in other words, if you fasted longer overnight, did you get a bigger effect?
Yes, we did see a linear trend. As the nighttime fasting interval increased, the concentration of these biomarkers, A1C or postprandial glucose, decreased.
Now, if there is a solid link between, it's not just breast cancer we're talking about here, by the way, it's bowel cancer as well, but let's just talk about breast cancer. What could be the impact on breast cancer if what we know already is true?
It's hard to quantify an actual risk reduction in terms of increasing fasting by X amount, and we're actually looking at data right now to hopefully be able to quantify that in cohorts of women with long-term clinical outcomes to look at the actual effect that fasting might have. This needs to be reproduced both in other samples as well as tested in randomized controlled trials.
And which was more important? Because, you know, nighttime is a movable feast depending on the hours that you sleep. So, for example, you could be, you know, having a late dinner and sleeping till 8 a.m., which might give you 11 hours, or you could be an early eater and an early riser. How far into the day are you allowed to sleep for overnight fasting, given the body clock theory? Do you know?
That's a good question. We're still looking to better understand these relationships. You know, what time do you need to initiate or stop this fast to get protective associations?
How late can you cheat the next day when the sun's up?
Exactly. So, you know, you could technically achieve a long overnight fast by eating late at night and just skipping breakfast. We hypothesize that those are two biologically different behaviors, and the data from these animal models are suggesting that it really needs to be in line with sleep-wake cycles. We're hypothesizing that that would translate to something like stopping eating around 7 and fasting overnight. But in order to really get more data on that, we'd need to test it in humans.
Catherine Marinac, thank you for joining us on the Health Report.
Thank you so much.
Love it. Fasting between meals, just my speed. Catherine Marinac is in the Department of Health Sciences at the University of California, San Diego. And you're listening to the Health Report here on RN with me, Norman Swan. Major surgery is something most of us will experience one day. It can be traumatic, but it turns out that what doctors and nurses have done to you before, during and after the surgery, as opposed to the operation itself, can cause a fair bit of harm. Nick Christelis is a pain specialist and anaesthetist at the Alfred Hospital in Melbourne, and he's led a team which has radically changed the approach to hip and joint replacements.
It's about focusing medicine on the patient as opposed to the disease or the illness at hand. It's about reducing morbidity, which is sickness around coming into hospital. It's about reducing mortality, which is the death rate, ultimately increasing patient satisfaction and getting patients out of hospital quicker.
And you're talking about hip and knee replacements. So what was the situation before you did the study?
Generally, we know that hip and knee replacements are one of the commonest surgeries done now with people getting arthritis. And it's quite a big surgery. It's a big trauma to the patient. It's a big trauma to the body. Essentially, any surgery on the body leads you to drop off your levels of function. So people in the good old days used to take weeks, sometimes months, to recover from surgery. What we found is by changing the way we approach this, by looking at a patient-centered, evidence-driven package of care, we can actually reduce a number of bad outcomes for these particularly large operations.
And what you took was an approach which looked at what is commonly called the patient journey. In other words, from before they arrived at hospital through the hospital admission to discharge.
From start to finish. And when I say start, I mean even healthy people should be looking at keeping themselves well in the lead up to surgery that we all may have.
So the fitter you are before the surgeon chops you, the better.
Absolutely. Your drop-in function amounts to hours and days as opposed to weeks and months.
And people underestimate that. So just take us through the process that you instituted.
For example, when the surgeon said, right, I need to operate on this person, they need to have a formal pre-assessment by a whole group of experts. So this includes the anaesthetist, it includes nurse coordinators, orthopedic coordinators, physiotherapists, dietitians, and everyone really looking at the patient and deciding how best we're going to manage them in this whole journey that they're about to undertake.
So this isn't on the morning of admission?
No, this happens pre-admission. One of the key things about this is changing patients' expectations, and this is the most important thing, because we've all been taught, if you go into a hospital, you need to be sick. Well, now we're promoting a wellness model of care, so the patients are involved in the build-up to surgery. Sometimes they even get a choice of dates that they can have their surgery.
Actually, there's an interesting story around choice of dates, is that when you give people the choice of dates as they do in the private system, waiting lists start to disappear because people don't necessarily want it next week. They're happy for it to be scheduled for just before Christmas.
That's right. But it involves really promoting a wellness of care, and that means every member of the team needs to reinforce to the patient that they're not going to be unwell after the surgery. They're going to be up and about within hours of having their surgery. They're going to be eating and drinking within hours of having their surgery.
So it's a couple of the 16 things that you do. You've got a nurse coordinator, you've got a physiotherapist, you've got a dietitian visiting the person. Is it the week before, the month before, 3 months before? Because, I mean, if they're not that well, you need a bit of time to actually put in a program to start building up your muscles or what have you.
Sure. Well, it was, I think on average, it was probably a couple of months before because of preparing the patient appropriately. So getting them to improve their levels of activity, getting them to have a bit of physiotherapy, really educating the patients on what to expect when they get into hospital.
And the next thing that you did was, you know, everybody's told you've got to fast overnight, and then the theatre list is late. You're feeling pretty crap before you actually get the anaesthetic.
People get to us being dehydrated, they're cold, they're a bit nauseated because they haven't been feeding well. So you start off with somebody that's already unwell, and this is all doctor-induced being unwell. I mean, as an anaesthetist for a long time now, even to get my head around the fact that I'm about to anaesthetize somebody that's been drinking until 2 hours ago, it is a shift in change, and it takes time to change practice.
And it doesn't increase risk?
It doesn't increase risk. If anything, it reduces risk because you've got somebody that's hydrated, you've got somebody that's had a carbohydrate load, so they're ready to withstand.
So tell me about the carbohydrate load.
Well, it's basically just preparing patients for the trauma and the stress of surgery. What people don't realize is that when you have a surgery, the body reacts as far as hormones goes like they've been hit by a car. So there's a huge shift in hormones and a huge shift in enzymes and various chemicals within the body. And this basically knocks a person off their perch, if you want to look at it that way.
So how do you carb load them?
It's a hypoosmolar drink that they can take up to about 2 hours pre-op, and it's been shown to not increase the risk of people vomiting or aspirating, as we call it, around the time of surgery.
So it's a bit like a sports drink.
Yeah, it works.
And how long do they have to stop eating solids, just in case somebody misunderstands our conversation here? You still stop solids more than 4 hours beforehand.
At 6 hours beforehand, that's exactly right. I mean, I wouldn't recommend anyone just eat and drink until 2 hours
bacon
before
and eggs,
surgery.
Yeah.
These enhanced recovery programs are done by centres where everything has been considered. I think in the build-up to surgery, 1 in 8 people were getting cancelled on the day of surgery in years gone by. If they were not very well, the hemoglobin levels were low, they had eaten or drunk. So having an enhanced pathway actually reduces the likelihood of people being cancelled on the day of surgery.
And then there's stuff that the anaesthetist does. So in the past, you've loaded people up with sedation and you've given them narcotics even before you've induced the anaesthesia and the theory that you're going to reduce pain.
It's relatively easy to give an anaesthetic. It's quite hard to give a good anaesthetic. So you've really got to look at the evidence. And the aim is, people don't understand this, when they're anaesthetized, their body still feels pain. So you need quite a big anaesthetic to stop the body reacting to pain. If I turn half of the body off with a spinal anaesthetic, which is an extension of what a lady gets when she has an epidural or a cesarean section, in effect, during the surgery, the patient does not mount that stress response to the pain, and hence they need very little anaesthetic to keep them asleep. So they wake up comfortable and they need much less pain control after the operation. And the key with pain control is to have a few pain medications rather than one pain medication in a big dose. And yes, we're going away from the opioids like morphine or oxycodone because they cause sedation, they cause nausea, and they really slow the recovery of these patients.
And you encourage the surgeons to do what people are used to, say, in the emergency departments, put in local anaesthetic around the wound.
It's not local anaesthetic around the wound, which is what we all do. We just squirt a bit of local anaesthetic on the skin. This is local anaesthetic in various layers during the surgery. So as they're operating, they're infiltrating local anaesthetic on nerves, on muscles, and it's a very specific thing that they do. Because if I know the surgeon's going to put in good local anaesthetic, well, I don't need to give them a lot of anaesthetic or a lot of pain medication through the case.
And there's much more attention to keeping you warm during the operation.
Actively warming patients. So we put these big hot air blowers on the patients, that fancy blankets that get hot air passed through them. We warm the fluids that we put into patients. So putting in cold fluid into a patient basically just cools them from the inside out.
And then cutting down on the morphine you give afterwards, because people, you know, hand out the old morphine pumps, and you're actually much more conservative about what you have after the operation.
Absolutely. If you give a good anti-inflammatory, if people are able to take anti-inflammatories with a couple of other types of pain medications, including simple things like paracetamol, newer pain medications called gabapentinoids that reduce nerve activity following surgery, you need to give a very small dose of morphine-based medication, and just for a number of days, not weeks.
And, I mean, all this is kind of important stuff for consumers to know, because they can start to query their surgeon about what they're going to do.
The patients need to start asking the right questions, and that means they're involved in their care. They want to be well through the time of their surgery. They want to be up and about really quickly after the surgery. And I stress, it's not one thing that makes the difference here. It's not the fact that the patient has had a spinal anaesthetic. It's the fact that everything is put together. Every single little step all counts in making the patient more satisfied and getting out of hospital quicker.
And more carb loading after the operation.
They can eat and drink almost straight away, and you'll find some amazing papers where you see people literally in the recovery room getting out of bed and walking around and starting their physio almost immediately.
Really?
Surgery.
Because you talk about within 24 hours, but you say there's nothing to stop you. I mean, the cement set, I mean, that's, it doesn't matter how the operation's done.
Absolutely. Operation is done. Again, you've got to find out, you know, what the surgeon's requests are. But if they're following the current evidence and guidelines, there's no reason why patients can't start the recovery, whether it be even on the bed in the recovery room.
You argue for a hospital discharge in under 5 days. Now, in the private sector, they often send you off to, you know, the rehabilitation hospital for hydrotherapy and, you know, a week or two of getting back on your feet, which you don't have that luxury necessarily in the public sector. Are you condemning people to delayed rehabilitation if you're chucking them out under 5 days?
No. One of the things in Europe where enhanced recovery is basically part of the norm now is most people are discharged straight home. If you do this correctly, there's no need for people to always go to the rehab unit for rehabilitation, because they've basically done their rehab before they've had their surgery.
Now, knee arthroplasty, knee replacement, can be a pretty lousy operation through no fault of the surgeon, but it's just not a good operation. And people have more pain than they were led to realize compared to a hip replacement. Is there a difference between people who've had their knees done versus their hips? Because people can be bitterly disappointed with their knee replacement.
Knee replacement is a huge operation. There can be significant blood loss. It can be significantly long operation. And of course, having some foreign body put in your body is not without risk of infection, fractures. It can move as time goes on. And the key thing is to get that knee moving post-operatively. In other words, if that knee stays stiff, it's going to be really hard to rehabilitate.
Now, this is in the public sector, and the results of your study showed that it improves hospital discharge. And, well, just give me the results of the study. What did you find?
One of the things we found is that we could reduce the hospital stay, but also, more importantly, we could improve the time when the patient was ready for discharge. So at day three, I think the patients ready for discharge improved from 40% to 60%, which is not insignificant.
And did you follow them up afterwards to see how they've gone at home?
Yeah, we followed them up. I think it was at 6 weeks and 3 months, and the side effect or complication rate was essentially the same as the patients that stayed in hospital for longer. Patient satisfaction was markedly improved, and the overall quality of recovery was improved as well. Patients had better pain control, and there was a tendency to be more mobile and have a better range of movement as well, because their pain was so well controlled.
Now, in the public sector, there's an incentive to do this. First of all, the hospital network has a budget. You know, the hospital managers can decide where they're going to spend that budget. And if they want to spend it on a physiotherapist going to the house, they can, particularly if there's a saving at the other end in terms of readmission rates or early discharge. It's not so easy in the private sector. Even if an orthopedic surgeon loved this idea and was willing, he or she is not remunerated to do this sort of work. There aren't the Medicare benefits schedule items to send the physio out. I mean, it suggests that you're not necessarily going to get the standard of care in the private sector through the fault of nobody but the system.
But there's no reason why this can't happen in the private sector. And in fact, since we've been doing this project, I've had a couple of private hospital groups of anaesthetists contact me, and I'm guiding them in setting up a couple of pathways. It doesn't have to be exactly the way we've done it. It can be whatever works for that group. In the private sector, generally you've got the same surgeon and the same anaesthetist and the same team, and it's a much smaller group. Whereas in the public sector, we've got tens of surgeons, sometimes even hundreds of anaesthetists. So that's quite hard in coordinating patient care.
So the words to use when you're having a consultation with your private doctor, if it is a private doctor, is do you subscribe to an enhanced recovery regime and what is it? And the same story if you're going to a public outpatient and you're being booked for a knee replacement or a hip replacement.
Absolutely. And the other thing just to mention is that this is not only for hip and knee replacements. This can be for any form of major surgery. And they're really pushing the boundaries overseas, doing it for operations on the lungs, doing it for really major abdominal operations, major cancer operations. Not saying that it needs to be done, but it can be done for almost any form of surgery.
Nick, thank you for joining us on the Health Report.
You're very welcome.
Nick Christelis is a pain specialist and anaesthetist at the Alfred Hospital in Melbourne. So you're listening to the Health Report. I'm Norman Swan. Now, the next story is an interesting one because it's about stuff we've covered before, about pancreatic cancer and targeted therapy, really important. And Australia's had a revolutionary trial in this area, trying to pick patients who might have genetic abnormalities and tailoring the therapy to them. And the trial failed, but it failed in an interesting way. And we don't often talk about failures on the Health Report, but we've got a lot to learn from this because it's about the promise that targeted medicine offers. And with me in the studio is Lorraine Chantrell, who is a medical oncologist in Southwest Sydney at the MacArthur Cancer Centre and also at the Garvan and Kinghorn Institutes, a pancreatic cancer researcher. So Lorraine, you know, this is your big moment to talk about, to talk about a failure.
Yeah, thank you, Norman. And I hope that it will be a success eventually. But you're right. If we measure our success by the number of patients whose treatment has been changed by our research, then at the moment we're failing. But what
we tell us about the trial.
The trial started out to try to make use of some of the genomic information that we were gaining during the big cancer sequencing project that Australia was involved with pancreatic cancer. And we had hoped that we could use that information to inform the treatment for people whose cancer recurred or became metastatic. Before it did, we hoped we had the results and we'd be able to change their treatment.
So you'd sequenced the tumours in these people,
right,
looking for genetic abnormalities, yes, that you could treat.
And these were tumours that at the time were considered curable and operable. But we know that unfortunately in pancreatic cancer, the vast majority of patients recur even when they've had what was intended to be a curative operation. So we were hoping to use that information gained from their primary tumour to inform treatment if and when they developed advanced disease.
So tailored treatment for their genetic situation.
Right, exactly. But unfortunately, just the way things worked, by the time we had our trial open and running at sites in Sydney, most of the patients for whom we had sequenced data were already either deceased or they were probably cured of their disease because they hadn't recurred after quite a few years. So we had to think again, and really the demand was coming from people who present to the cancer clinic with advanced pancreas cancer. Those were the people who really wanted some new and different treatment, and we really wanted to offer this targeted treatment to those people. So what we did is we changed our study and we decided to try to test biopsy material from people who already had advanced pancreas cancer. And that's actually quite a difficult thing to do because it means doing our analysis very quickly. Because as you know, pancreas cancer, when it's advanced, is a very fast-moving disease and people get sick quickly and unfortunately die usually within months.
You want this to be in the time frame of a blood test.
Exactly. But at the moment, our average time to deliver the results from the moment the patient consents to screening is still 23 days.
23 days?
Yeah.
But you've got this massive machine at the Garvan that can,
yes,
chew this away at a great rate.
But what we've learned is it's not the time taken for the technology to do the analysis. It's the time taken to get the biological specimens to our lab that is the most difficult time to control. Sometimes that piece isn't enough, or we've had to get tissue from laboratories some distance away because we have offered this screening to patients all over the country. So at times it's taken us almost a week just to get the tissue to the lab.
So by the time you're ready to recruit a person to a trial, it's almost too late.
Yes, so which is why we've changed the way our trial works now, and we're allowing people to begin treatment while they're waiting for our results. So no longer are no longer are we asking them to wait for the results before we initiate treatment. We're saying, okay, go ahead and have the first cycle of standard therapy, and we hope to deliver the results of your analysis within a 28-day time frame, which is the time that it takes to have one cycle of standard therapy. And then if there is a target there, you could then start the targeted treatment from cycle two, as it were.
And you're not randomizing.
No, so that's another new thing we've done.
The benchmark here is a randomized clinical trial, which is your right. best therapy against the new therapy.
That's right, Norman, and that is the paradigm on which most oncology trials work. But we found that that was not palatable for people with pancreas cancer. They did not want to have to possibly get the standard therapy. If they were going to be screened for a targeted treatment and indeed had an eligible target, they wanted to make sure that they could get that treatment.
But of course, tragically, with pancreatic cancer, you'll know quite quickly. You don't need to randomize for pancreatic cancer because so many people regrettably die of this. And if yes. you increase survival, you'll know very quickly.
Yes, we hope so. And indeed, you're right. There are new ways of doing things where perhaps we could compare with control patients who are having non-targeted treatment at the same time with the same level of cancer. But as you know, it's never perfect to compare that way.
The fascinating thing then with this study, it's called the IMPACT trial, is which held up so much promise, is that what you've discovered is that it's fine to have the promise of personalized medicine and personalized care. But unless you get the supply chain right, the logistics right, I mean, it's almost like running Woolies. You've actually got to have this running like a factory process, delivering outcomes in a very timely way, efficiently. Otherwise, the logistics defeat you.
Absolutely. And I think if we do one thing, it's to teach people the ways in which you can do this. And we're still hoping that we can actually do this properly, having learned all of these things.
You're just off the bus from the United States, where you presented this, which must have been unique in a cancer conference to present a trial that didn't work. Was anybody else willing to be as honest as you were at the meeting?
Yes, look, I think other places are having similar problems. I think the problems in pancreas cancer are so much more difficult because of the time course of disease. But yes, I think others are encountering similar issues. I don't think we are alone. And we are, I think, really at the forefront of trying to do this in the clinic.
So the tumours here that have this sort of short time frame are lung cancer, ovarian cancer, pancreatic cancer.
Exactly.
Other cancers like breast, you may actually have a little bit of time to play
yes,
with.
Yes, and you know, the melanoma is a good example of a disease which has enjoyed targeted treatment and it's been very successful. But you could argue that maybe access to tissue in melanoma is much more straightforward than in something like pancreas cancer.
Because you're taking a biopsy from the skin rather than deep inside the body and trying to aim a needle at it.
Exactly, and we don't feel comfortable in pancreas cancer asking patients to have additional procedures which might be risky and delay their treatment further. It's difficult.
So Lorraine Chantrell, you'll come back and talk to us about IMPACT 3 or 4
5? I will report the successes of it, I hope, Norman. Yes.
And whether you're asking Woolworths to do the trucking for you. Yeah. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me, Norman.
Dr. Lorraine Chantrell is a medical oncologist in Southwest Sydney and at the Kinghorn Institute and the Garvan Institute in Sydney. I'm Norman Swan and you've been listening to The Health Report. Next week, has the glycemic index taken a fatal knock? Plus the people who are obese at a BMI of 24. That's next week on The Health Report. See you then.